that is one of the most important things, is that the government has to be accountable to the public. And the public has a right to know many things, to know not everything sometimes when it's classified, but like every, you know, and that, by the way, is another misconception that sometimes the public thinks that they should know absolutely everything. And I'm like, not always. It's often for your safety that you don't. Right? But like that, but they should hold the government accountable, and the press should be difficult with you.
Hello, everybody. I'm excited to welcome another incredible guest to the pod today. Hagar Shamali is an American political satirist, writer, political commentary, foreign policy expert, and host and creator of an award-winning world news show on YouTube called Oh My World. She's held senior national security and political affairs positions under the Barack Obama and George W. Bush administrations and is featured regularly on MSNBC, CNN, BBC, and Bloomberg. Whew, that is an impressive bio. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here with you both.
We are so excited. I think I have the privilege to have known you for like 2 years now. So, but our audience doesn't know you. So we would love to know, where did you grow up? As a kid, did you think you would be doing this, what you're doing now? Where did you go to school?
So I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, born and raised. Both my parents came from Beirut. And I like to say that I chose living in Greenwich, Connecticut, because they had fled the Civil War. And this is a really important piece, because I always say my story starts with my parents. They fled the Lebanese Civil War after my dad had been kidnapped and brutally beaten. And he was released on the condition that they would leave Lebanon, essentially. And so they left, both my parents left in a very quick way. And they toured the world for 3 months. And they were visiting friends in Greenwich, Connecticut, and my mom at that point was 5 months pregnant with me, and they had decided actually to live in Milan, Italy. So I could have been like, you know, Sophia or something, Alessandra. But she ended up facing a complication with the pregnancy and couldn't travel. And my dad was like, this is great. I want to stay in New York. This is a great idea. Let's stay here. And so I like to say that I chose Greenwich, Connecticut. So I was born and raised in Greenwich and to two Lebanese parents. And because they had really raised me with, you know, understanding and really having a passion for international affairs, and understanding their stories, right? Their stories, the stories of their family, of all kinds of different injustices, you know, religious persecution and exile and genocide. I had one great-grandfather who was Armenian who escaped the massacre in Diyarbakir in Turkey, for example. So, you know, I have a very mixed family on top of it. My mom is Lebanese Jewish. My dad is Lebanese Christian. I have some Persian and Armenian in there. So I like to say I'm also a Middle Eastern mutt. But given all these stories, the kidnapping, my dad faced, I mean, all of these stories, I was always raised with this interest in international affairs and politics in the Middle East in particular, but also this passion to fight against injustices, a range of injustices. And when I was in high school was when I knew this is what I wanted to do. And I was very fortunate for that, because I do a lot of mentoring now. And I always tell people it's just as valuable to know what you like as what you don't like. And that's true, and I believe very much in that. But I was really fortunate. At 14, I knew. And it was because of a history teacher who recommended I join Model UN. And I joined, and I fell in love. I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to broker peace around the world and combat conflict and terrorism. And so I tried to, you know, I tried to mold my academic background for that. And in college as well, and was really bent on working at the UN. And so I did two internships throughout my undergrad and graduate studies, which I did back to back. I stayed in the Northeast, and I went to Barnard College for my undergrad, which is the women's college at Columbia University, and where I majored in political science, and then stayed in a 5-year dual degree program where I could get my master's at the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia, and did that all in 5 years, which, by the way, for any young folks listening, I would not recommend doing it that way. They also don't recommend you do it that way, though they have this program. It is much more beneficial to go out and work and decide what you like, but in that time frame, had done two internships at the UN, and it was my second internship during where I was on the Iraq team, but you had the genocide in Darfur was happening at the time. And the woman handling Africa, who was the only woman in the office at that time in the Department of Political Affairs, lamented that, you know, nothing would happen without the U.S. leading on it. And that's when I was like, this place is feckless. I can't work here. I need to affect change for the better. So I have to go to the U.S. government. And that's really where, from there, I changed course, my course direction. And then from there, you know, pursued a career in the U.S. government.
Awesome. It's really interesting always to hear if people thought they were going to do their career from a young age or if that's something that came to them later on. I think I'm kind of somewhere in the middle, but my dad definitely, like, I think he's like you. When he was in middle school, he had a design teacher and he's been a lighting designer ever since. So I think it's really interesting to hear if people pick that up early or later on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. I loved it. And then I remember my history teacher, I was talking about the lack of women's rights in Saudi Arabia. I mean, I specifically remember what I was talking about.
Okay.
And he overheard me. It was before the class started. And he was like, you should try Model UN. And I didn't know what it was. And then I represented like Tunisia at the Security Council and decided to, and this is a long time ago, but it's still very relevant. And I decided to shit on the Taliban back then. This is a long time ago. But the Taliban was in power back then. And my parents were the ones who would inform me of all this. So we would talk about it at dinner and all day. And they just rings me with caring about these issues. And I was hooked after that. That's what I had to do. Was fight. And it's still the stuff when I do a lot of different things now. But anytime I get the opportunity to work on government-related projects, on issues related to real foreign policy or international affairs and strategizing and the crises that come with it is really when I get my blood going.
I love that.
Yeah.
So you've worked in national security roles for over a decade. What is like the most challenging moment that you have faced in government?
In government? Oh, that's a good question. It's so funny because I like to say that my most challenging, the hardest thing I ever had to do was launch my media brand, which was out of government. So we'll get to that. In government, the most challenging thing I would have to say is when there were 3 years where I was at the White House. I was director for Syria and Lebanon at the National Security Council. And this was the last 2 years of that were during the Arab Spring. And I handled Syria, obviously, so the first 2 years of the Syria crisis. And at the beginning, and I don't mean to say this in a dismissive way. It was a very exciting time to be handling this issue because it felt like we were making history and we were watching it unfold and we were figuring out the policy options and the pros and cons of each. And we had a very detailed strategy that made sense. And it was exciting because it felt like we were going to push this asshole out of office, right? Assad and Bashar the Butcher, as I call him on my show. And we were going to watch him fall, and we thought he would fall, and we genuinely, in the year 2011, thought he would fall by the end of the year. And we emptied the kitchen sink of sanctions, and we were working with other partners, and blah, blah, blah. And it was exciting. Then in 2012, things really started to fester. And the U.S. policy was not really affecting change in Syria, and couldn't. And there was a lack of willingness to lead on that and to go further into that and to really to change things further, to invest in a way that would change things in Syria, whether it meant military intervention or at that time arming the opposition, which we weren't doing at that time, you know, things of that kind. But the pressure was on me to fix it. And I know that sounds silly, as like I'm sure everybody listening is like, of course it wasn't on you Hogar, to fix it, but that is not at all how my bosses made it seem. In fact, I remember very clearly when there were things that nothing was working. And we had this 5-pronged strategy that I used to sell publicly very well to the press and deep down knowing that this strategy wasn't going to achieve our goals. And I remember at one point, I'm pretty sure it was the deputy national security advisor at the time that was like, Hogar, can't you think of anything else more creative? And military intervention was off the table. Anything military was off the table. And I remember sitting there being like, yeah, you could bomb a weapons depot in the middle of the night or a runway. That would work. That is a language Assad understands, but you don't want to do that. You don't even want to do that. Like, there's no civilians at risk there, right? There's no cost there. There's a minimal cost there. Trump ended up doing that, by the way, after I left and the Obama tenure ended and Trump came in, he did that. And so, you know, I remember it felt like it was on me. And so there were a few months there that it felt like my hands were tied behind my back. And the public discourse in Congress was shouting louder and louder that the White House wasn't doing anything on Syria. And I was the one that had to meet with Syrian and Syrian American constituents and explain to them this very flawed policy, right? And so, like, I was the one taking their beating to, you know, and that was part of my job, was to say, like, you know, tell me, yes, tell me what you want, tell me your concerns, and I'm going to relay it back to the White House. And they did, but, like, it wasn't going to change anything. And being in the middle like that was probably the hardest thing I ever had to do in government, because the beautiful thing about government and why I went is to affect change for the better. And that's why I didn't work at the UN. All those guys do is rub elbows and hobnob and write reports. And, you know, and I'll put aside the UN agencies in the field, but I'm talking about the secretary in New York. And that's why I went into sanctions, because sanctions, there was a real cause and effect there with your activities in you were getting money of criminal actors or freezing it or making it harder for them to then, it made it harder for them to pursue their criminal behavior. And this, I couldn't do anything. No policy, no idea, no, all I did was write paper after paper. And I had to see and know all the human rights abuses happening on the ground. And there are images I will never forget that really haunted me, but like to feel like you're powerless. So this was the hardest thing. And I ended up leaving, and I didn't like resign in protest. I left because I had been there a long time. I wanted a baby. I wanted, you know, to not work 18-hour days and 7 days a week. And I was done. They needed fresh blood. I told them that. I was like, I'm burned out. Like, you need fresh blood. So that's why I left. But I was very disappointed in the policy, for sure. And that was definitely the hardest thing I had to do in government.
Wow. I mean, working at the White House, those are two, like, heavy words. It's insane. Yeah. Like, the White House. Wow. So we talked about the challenges, but what's one misconception people have about working in national security and public affairs?
Ooh, this is a couple things. So one major misconception is that the U.S. government is spying on everybody, particularly Americans. And they don't have the time for that. Like, that whole idea is crazy to me. And I'm not saying that Americans don't have the right to privacy. Not only do we have the right to privacy, it's enshrined in our Constitution. So, you know, I'm not trying to make it seem like the government should be, you know, like the Chinese regime and surveil us like crazy. But there's this belief that the U.S. government is not... You know, it's harder to say. It's a bit harder to say in the current phase that we're seeing a little bit. So I want to be very careful here. But is hunting down American citizens and listening to our conversations and distorting, you know, things and so on. And I understand, you know, and this could be a flaw in me. I'm a bit more trustful of the U.S. government than I think most people who have not worked in the U.S. government are. And I see all the good that the U.S. government does. And there's always this misconception that you can't trust anything that the U.S. government is doing. They have these powers and that they go largely unchecked. That's also not true. All powers are really very heavily checked. Even when you have one political party in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House, like you do now, right now, for example, sure, it makes it easier for certain laws to pass, but that doesn't mean that the power is unchecked. And I hear it still all the time. Now, I know right now we're in a new phase under the Trump administration, and they are doing things that we've never seen previous administrations do. But there's still, and I wouldn't say you want to trust the government blindly, but they don't have time to be hunting down the regular law-abiding citizen. That's just not what they do. They don't have time for that. They're trying to, if they have powers that are, for example, one of them that people debate all the time is about, is FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that allows the government to surveil foreigners and foreigners inside the United States as well without a warrant. And so there's this belief that, like, there should be a warrant, but the FBI has said over and over again, we can't have a warrant. You don't understand how fast sometimes these things unfold, and we need an authority to be able to, sometimes we learn of a terrorist plot and we got to go right then and there and get, you know, thwart it. And that is true. And they're not sitting there listening to, like, your phone call with your friend. I always thought that was a misconception. And the other one is that people don't know how much good the U.S. government does. It seems like this big, bad behemoth. And they do so much good. Now, some of that good was through USAID, and a lot of that's been dismantled. But they still do so much good. Like, even with the things that have been dismantled under the Trump administration, you still have so many grants and programs that people aren't aware of. That it's just that now they don't know it, they don't see it, the government's not good at communicating it. And that's because, like, we drink news through, like, a 24/7 fire hose, right? So they don't have time to go and, like, showcase this one program that feeds kids across the country, or that, you know, pursues these vaccines in the country, or so on and so forth. And again, I want to be careful. I know that there's a lot being dismantled right now. I would say those are the two things that people don't understand or appreciate that much. They think that it's like that they're listening in on everything, and that they have the time or desire to do that, and that they're just like this bad, you know, evil behemoth that lies all the time. And that's not true either.
I think we all needed to hear that.
I'm glad.
Everything is bad.
Yeah, you know, this came up now. This comes up all the time, I find, with there's a... And again, I don't like being in the position of defending any. I myself am a centrist. I sit in the middle. I make a big point, as you did in your intro, of saying that I worked both for George Bush and Obama. And it is a very hard line to walk. Like, it's a remain objective, because in this climate in particular, people think that you're defending. But I had this whole argument with somebody the other day about this bill that requires citizens to prove that they're a citizen in order to vote. So you have to prove you're a citizen either when you register, or you have to update your registration to vote. And there was this rumor that just, like, blew up by liberal media that was, and by left-wing think tanks, saying that it would prevent married women who chose to take their husband's name to vote because their birth certificate wouldn't match their current name.
I think I remember this. I've heard this before.
This is asinine. Because I can't even, not only is it unconstitutional, it's completely, it's not even in the bill anywhere. Like, none of this makes any sense. But, you know, everyone fucking crazy right now. Everyone is crazy right now. And they can't, you know, and they're being fed something. And they're so angry and so anxious because they can't trust. And I understand that. You don't want to trust blindly. That's never smart in general. But you shouldn't trust what you're reading either blindly. And so, you know, I had this conversation with a group of friends, and I took out the bill. And I was like, okay, listen, you have to read the bill itself. There are all these ways you can prove citizenship. First of all, no, you don't have to do it in person. No, it doesn't have to be your birth certificate. You know, and I understand it could disenfranchise, actually. I think the issue here is that it's there to push a narrative. That's why this thing exists. It's there to push a narrative that Democrats are trying to allow migrants to legalize them, or to make them citizens so that they vote. And so this whole conspiracy theory, that's what this bill is meant to do, is to push that message, and it might disenfranchise poorer people. That's what it could do. It's not to target married women. That's absurd. But, you know, it's hard. Yeah, I find I really make a point of trying to, like, stay objective and do my research and try to present things in as calm a way as possible. Because otherwise we'll all lose our minds. You know, we'll all end up in therapy, you know, or we'll all, like, eat too much chocolate. Don't lose your body for this administration. That's absurd. Don't do that. You know, don't lose sleep. You know, you have to stay vigilant and aware, but also don't go crazy.
I think that's an important note. Definitely.
Yeah.
So we talked a bit about it, and how you said your teacher was a big mentor for you, but do you have someone that comes to mind in your early career that was a big mentor, and some advice they might have given you early on?
So first, I collect mentors, and I kind of have this group of them. I call them my network of champions, because they're always championing me on. And you know, in any phase, whether I'm succeeding at something and they're praising me, or I have a problem and they're so good at listening and giving, you know, objective advice and solutions. So I have several. In terms of which would have given me the most valuable advice, I have a lot, but I have to say that the person I go back to over and over again, and again, there are so many, but I'm going to go to an older one who's been with me the longest, I guess, because it's just been so much advice, is my very first boss at Treasury, at the Treasury Department. His name is Danny Glaser. And Danny and I remain very good friends, one of my best friends, and also a mentor. And he's given me so much advice through the years. If I had to say one of the most valuable, he's always used to tell me to let go of big arguments, right? Like, always let go of these arguments. But he was, one of the things he trained me on is how small Washington is. And D.C. is small. how small Washington is and how important it is to maintain relationships and friendships with people, and to never act like never let the power go to your head, because you are going to move up the ranks, and you see it in Washington all the time where people, they move up and then the power goes to their head and they become assholes. And he always reminded me not to do that, right? To know, no matter what position I hit, to always be, to treat everybody well, to call them up and or meet with them in person. Don't text, don't email, like, right? Like, because somebody might not understand what you're saying. Like, it's much better to establish those relationships. And that has stayed with me to this day. It's why I can work. It's why I have friends on both sides. It's why I have friends everywhere, really. And it has served me in my career as a freelancer after, you know, whether I'm doing commentating on networks or whether I have consulting work. You know, it's, I never treated anyone badly, because, and this would be, by the way, I don't think this is just in Washington. I bet this is every industry. If you treat people badly or you snap at them or you whatever, that reputation will go with you. Or somebody will call up somebody and say, hey, I'm going to be hiring this person. And, you know, they didn't put you as a recommender, but I know they worked for you. You know, people never just call recommenders. You know, they worked for you. What do you have to say about them? And you don't want them saying, you know, bad things, and because it can really ruin your career. So I think that was possibly the most valuable.
I love that. And you just mentioned something about how things can get confused when we text or we email people, right? And we're talking about just general conversations, like day-to-day conversations. Now, you deal with like such complex topics during your work. And I also deal with, I do social media for a nonprofit, and we treat like these sensitive topics too. And so I think my question is, how did your time working in government positively shape the way you communicate complex global issues in your media work today? Because I feel like the way you convey this, it's very like captivating, fast. You're so charismatic. So how do you do it?
So mostly is my own personality. You know, government, what government trained me in, well, first I discovered the love of explaining geopolitics when I was in government. And it was when I was in that position at the White House, handling Syria. I spent, toward the end, when I mentioned I had that really rough year where things were just festering, the only thing I looked forward to was the 30 minutes a day I would spend on the phone with reporters explaining to them a very flawed, admittedly very flawed policy, which at a certain point felt like a moral, you know, morally wrong. And that's really when I decided I had to go. But that's when I wasn't a communications person. I was a foreign policy person. And at the very beginning, I remember I was very apprehensive to even speak to the press. I was trained at Treasury where you did not speak to the press. We were locked up like a fortress. And, but really found this love and of explaining things to people. And I had the energy for it. I'd get really excited about it. So when I went back to Treasury, I've convinced everyone there after a while to make me spokesperson for terrorism and financial intelligence. And it was my most favorite job in government because I got to marry this policy side, right? Like understanding terrorism and sanctions and illicit finance with explaining it to the press and the public every day, which I think is a fundamentally, like, the most important part of our democracy. I mean, there are many things actually that are very important to our democracy. That is one of the most important things, is that the government has to be accountable to the public, and the public has a right to know many things, to know not everything sometimes when it's classified, but like every, you know, and that, by the way, is another misconception that sometimes the public thinks that they should know absolutely everything. And I'm like, not always. It's often for your safety that you don't, right? But like but they should hold the government accountable, and the press should be difficult with you. And it's one of the things I always joke about when people say, like, oh, the press beats up on naming your spokesperson, right? Like, and I'm like, that's literally their job. That's how it's supposed to work. So that job, I think, in particular, or maybe the first one too, the Syria one, really brought that out in me, because I was explaining really complex things. Especially sanctions. When you're talking about sanctions, and I worked on it in that world for 4 years, and was trained in like really nerd training here, trained in assessing countries for how good they were at their anti-money laundering laws and counter-terrorist financing laws. You really have to be trained in this like nitty-gritty, nerdy part of this, and then to explain that to the public and to try to do it really quickly and easily. And I just kind of got, I get really excited about it. And they would tell me over and over again, the reporter would say, like, nobody explains sanctions this way, you know, everyone else. And I had all sorts of different analogies I'd make, right? Like one of my favorite one, and I did it on Rachel Maddow's show once when the Russia war, when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, and the Biden administration rolled out all these sanctions, and like people were like, ah, sanctions. And I was out there being like, no, you don't understand, these are major sanctions. This is the biggest, I've never seen them so big. And so I was doing a lot of TV and I was on Rachel Maddow's show, and I literally, and I talk with my hands a lot. And I said, I was like, you know, it's like an onion. Cause they were talking about like, what good is it to sanction Putin? Like who cares? And I was like, okay, imagine an onion and Putin is the center. Okay. And you've just sanctioned the center of it. But there are all these other layers, right? He's got these other businesses and these properties and his spouse, and his spouse probably has other these properties. I was like, if all of that, if he owns something 50% or more, all of that is automatically sanctioned. So all those layers of the onion are sanctioned. I was like, and Treasury, their whole job is to continue sanctioning those layers of the onion so that Putin, no matter where he turns, he's blocked, right? There are no wormholes out of the onion. And so, you know, and I'm Rachel Maddow, I remember her saying, she was like, wow, yeah, nobody has ever described sanctions this way. You have a way of describing it that really made sense. So I think I just really enjoy it. Talking is definitely my favorite activity. So, but I found this out later in life. And this, again, this is why I said earlier in the podcast, it's one of the reasons why I say that people should work first before going to grad school. Because had I done that and discovered this, I probably would have pursued my degree more in a mix of foreign policy and communications. I would have done both. Now, I learned communications on the job, which was great also. And now I teach communications at my alma mater, at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia, which is wonderful. But it really, this knack came out of me. And when I told, this is the beauty of government too, when you get into government, you don't really apply to any jobs after that. Like you can, there are sometimes applications, but really it's all like you bounce around, right? The doors just open and you bounce around to different agencies. Maybe there's an opportunity at an embassy abroad. You know, a lot of it is really that you're working on these issues. You get to know many different people in different offices or around the world. And then they'll say, you know, either your boss moves somewhere and they want to take you with them, or like, somebody you work with says, oh, well, I want to take them to the White House for a year or two, or I want to take them to this embassy for a year or two. So you have these endless opportunities, which is wonderful. And when I told Dan Glaser, same guy, when I told him when I was at the White House and I was like, I really think I want to switch to public affairs. And he was like, oh my God, you'd be amazing at public affairs. You'd be so good at it. And I was like, yeah, except I don't have formal training in dealing with the press, like, you know, other than talking to them. And he helped me actually ultimately get that job at Treasury to come back and be spokesperson. So again, the value of those mentors. But yeah, but so it was a natural knack in me that government kind of brought out in me.
Interesting. I guess just out of pure curiosity, do you think a lot of DC is like that? You can kind of move on from one job to a next in kind of a ebb and flow fashion. Is that something that you think a lot of people experience?
You know, well, I might be saying it from a fortunate standpoint. Like I had a really amazing run in government. I hope to go back to government one day in the future. And the hardest part really is getting the foot in the door. And I always say that to people. And it's true. It's true for me. It's true for everybody who starts out that way. But,
yeah, but definitely, I think I've heard this about DC. I've heard other people talk in that way where it's like, once you're in DC, it just like, things just keep flowing. So to hear you say that as well, I think it's just like, kind of a common experience for DCers.
It's a really small town. It's funny. One of my professors when I was in college said this about Washington, and I repeat this to everybody because it's so true, which is that if you want to work in Washington, just get to Washington, like physically get yourself to Washington. And it's so true. And by the way, for the work I do now, I have to be in Washington at least once or twice a month. And when I'm there, it's like, you know, the what you learn just through osmosis, and you bump into people everywhere because it's so small. And so every place you go to for lunch or dinner, or there's a conference or an event, and you cannot not bump into so many people. Now, I worked there for 12 years, so I'm going to bump into a lot of people, right? Because I know everybody. But even when I first got there, when I left grad school, It wasn't seamless at the beginning. I had taken at that time a conditional offer of employment from the CIA. What that means is that they offered you a job. They had offered me a job as an analyst, which I was really excited about. They first wanted me for operations, by the way. And I entertained it. Like, I was really into it from a movie type of standpoint, like a Hollywood standpoint. And then it was after 9/11. They wanted people just like me, you know, born and raised in the United States, speaks English perfectly, speaks Arabic, understands the culture, understands both cultures, but is very, you know, America minded. But the same people who wanted me are not the same in the security office. So, which I'll get to that. So, I went down this path of exploring operations, thinking I'd have, like, you know, a camera in my bra and like a gun in my pocket. And I was excited. And then when I learned that a lot of it was really like driving around and picking up sources and paper, I was like, what? What are you talking about? That's so boring. And they're like, you can't tell anybody what you do. I was like, Or I can't stop talking. I can't like not tell people what I do. Tell them that I'm like a florist in Saudi Arabia. No one's gonna believe that. So I very quickly learned that operations was not for me in this era. But being an analyst was. And so they offered that job to me on the condition that I get a security clearance. And at that time, you needed it. They didn't have a time frame on getting a security clearance. So I went to Capitol Hill in the meantime, working for my congressman from Connecticut, Chris Shays, who was just amazing. They don't make him like him anymore. He never voted with party. He was a moderate Republican, but like not moderate today. Like he would have been maybe center or center left today, but you know, always voted with his heart. And he was an amazing boss. But anyway, I did that and I was a fellow. I was kind of like a glorified intern and then a fellow, and my parents supported me, which was very lucky. But just by physically being in Washington, waiting for that security clearance and working on the Hill, I just made so many connections. And I got a job with the Peace Corps, which I ended up not taking. And from there, any interview I requested, or application I put in, I got, because Capitol Hill experience was really valuable. You know, but sitting here, you know, in the New York area, applying to things, it was just much harder. So I always tell people who are trying to get into this, who are younger, I'm like, take anything, even if it's a fellowship and it's for the summer, get there, find a way to fund it for a short period of time. It's not going to be more than 6 months. And like all these openings come up and you make all these connections. And if you're an intern or a fellow, they're going to want to hire you because they've trained you already. They don't like to spend their time looking for people. So yeah, I always say that. So I do think that it's not new. And it really, it's so funny because from the time I got into government, particularly like even treasury was through connections, right? I had a grad school friend there. I met with him, then I met his boss, blah, blah, blah. But from that point onward, or from Capitol Hill onward, the CIA job never ended up panning out. I never got that clearance. From Capitol Hill onward, I never applied for a position ever. Like never wrote a cover letter, never applied. It was only while I was in school that I did that. And then I didn't do it again, believe it or not, until last year. So you're talking like 20 years later.
Wow.
20 years later, consulting, I'm a consultant. That's what I do. That's the part of what I do for money. And consulting was just a drought. And so I was like, I think it's time to look for full-time positions. And I had to like straight up apply, like write a cover letter. It wasn't just a cover letter and like resume. It was like, you know, detailed processes and testing. And one job had like, you know, last minute tasks they would give us where we'd have to give these presentations. And you know, it felt like McKinsey, you know, like, and I remember being like, what on earth? This is awful. I can't do this. You know, like, why can't I just go to someone and be like, hire me? Like, my resume speaks for itself, doesn't it? Anyway, it ended up all turning around. And this year, like a flood of clients came in. And one of them in particular was the opportunity to work work behind the scenes on Lebanon-Israel issues, which is really, really exciting. And for me personally, very exciting. So that's what I ended up deciding to do instead of working full-time somewhere.
I love that. Trust me, I can relate to the crazy world of applying to jobs. It's insane out there at the moment. But okay, so after 12 years, you made a very big jump. And I know we kind of gave a short intro in the beginning, but can you give the audience a little bit more background into what Oh My World is and its mission?
Yeah. So when I switched to public affairs and government, I knew I wanted to be on TV too. It wasn't just that I liked explaining US foreign policy to the public and wanted to do it for the government. I wanted to do it for a network after leaving government. And I knew that. And so when I left, by then I was back up in New York. I was spokesperson for the US mission to the UN, which was great because the New York is really the center, the headquarters for media. And so I got to know a lot of people there. And when I left, I started doing commentating and writing on all things foreign policy and national security. And I still do. And I love the glamour of all of it. And I love, getting to know these anchors. And I love getting gussied up and being in a studio. And I love the whole thing about it. But it's a bit performative at the end of the day. And they are often looking for political sound bites. And I'm not that person. Like I said, I'm objective. I'm an equal opportunist when it comes to criticism and praise. And not all anchors like that, and not all networks like that. So the ones that still have me on a lot are the ones that appreciate that nerdy side to me. But that said, it just felt like it was a performance for an audience, for a very limited audience. And I'm not trying to say that my audience with Oh My World competes with the audiences of CNN and MSNBC. But the difference is that it has the chance to. And it has the chance to, and it's mission-based. Whereas those networks are not mission-based. They're driven by business. And they really are, right? That's why, for example, an anchor, or even an anchor who likes having me on because I'm nerdy, it's not totally up to them. It's up to their bosses. And they're going to want somebody who is controversial, who's provocative, who's going to evoke anger and fear and emotion, because that's what gets clicks and that's what get right. So it's a business run by a bottom line. And I think that's what got to me in the whole process. And again, like I said, I still like it, but I wanted to launch something that was mission-based, that was all about raising awareness of these issues, in a way that I thought the majority of the American audience wanted, which was in an easy way, in a fun way, and in an educational way, like where I give the background so that they get what's going on. And also in a fun way, right? So I dress up like a lot of world leaders, as you both have seen. I dress up like I'm often in a wig with a bad accent. And this is what makes it so much fun. And to me, the satire just pops out. The satire, believe it or not, wasn't part of this goal. So the wheels start turning. And another one of my mentors in 2019, Gretchen Carlson, who you may have heard of, she was a famous Fox News anchor. She sued Roger Ailes for sexual harassment, and really was one of the big triggers of the Me Too movement. And Gretchen is a very, very good friend of mine, also a mentor of mine. And she took me out to lunch in 2019 and was like, "Listen, you're doing a lot of TV and you're great at it, but they're not paying you, and it has to stop." And everybody should know this. They don't pay experts on air. So when you are invited as a guest expert, you're not paid. Sometimes you can make it a contributorship. A contributorship is when they say, like, "Okay, we let you know you're on so much." It actually doesn't really matter how often you're on. I'm on all the time, but like, we've decided to make you a contributor, which means that you're exclusive to that network. So for me, if it was like a contributor with CNN, I could only go on CNN to talk foreign policy and national security. And so they, I, she was like, "You got to get paid. This isn't like you're doing too much TV. You're giving the what's the expression? The milk for free, the whatever." And so I was like, "I'm trying." I told her, I was like, "I'm trying everything. I'm meeting with the talent people. I'm trying to play hard to get. I'm trying to make them jealous. And like, it's not working. They keep giving me this runaround of, oh, we don't want foreign policy contributors right now." And meanwhile, at MSNBC, at least when that was happening, while they were telling me this and using me almost every day, they hired three male contributors, foreign policy contributors. I'm not talking about the others, like legal or political or whatever. Yeah, three. And so my female friends and I, who used to do this, got together. We all lamented the same thing. Like, what is it that like they're not willing to commit to us as a contributor, but the men they are? And like, we tried everything. We tried demanding. We tried getting agents. Like, it never nothing worked. So she said this to me, and I was already feeling the frustration. And I was like, "We all know cable news is dying anyway, if not dead." And so I don't know that I want to put all my eggs in that basket anyway, and like sell my soul to be a contributor for like 50 grand a year, where they like own me morning, noon, and night. And she was like, "I agree with you. I agree with you, but like, you got to figure this out. Like, stop saying yes to every single appearance." And so That's when the wheels started turning. And that weekend I was watching Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN, and he has a show focused on international affairs. And I'm not trying to endorse it because I don't think it's that good. And to be honest with you, I think he delivers the news in a very incomprehensible way. It's very hard to understand. And I'm a policy wonk and worked in government for a very long time. And I have my master's in this and I teach in this world. And I still find half of what he says incomprehensible. And I just think it reinforces this idea to the American public that foreign policy is for the elites only to discuss. And it's not delivered in a way that is interesting. It's dry. And then on top of it, they don't understand it. Like, you start with the conflict in Sudan, and the regular American viewer is like, why should I care about the conflict in Sudan? There are a lot of reasons you should care about the conflict in Sudan. One of them is one of our allies is literally arming one of these sides that has now officially been declared as committing genocide, right? Like, you know, these are things you want to know. But like, anyway, that's when the light bulb went off my head. And I was like, I'm going to make a show that is foreign policy and international affairs, but that's fun and easy and educational and for the masses, no matter what the age is. I think I targeted it young, but it was really meant for, when I said the masses, I meant the masses, like anybody. And I was thinking of people in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I live now, where I'm back. And like, everyone here is very educated and very successful. And none of them can point Lebanon on a map, you know, or Libya on a map. They don't even know they're two separate countries. Like, you know, and so I was thinking that in my mind, like, this is for them too. But they're interested. They're genuinely interested, but they're like, explain it to me. I don't get the beef between China and Taiwan. I don't get between China and Hong Kong. Like, you know, you walk it back a little bit for them and then you put on a wig and a costume and they love the whole thing. And then they care. They get to care. And that was the point of it. And so that's ultimately how I launched. I launched in May of 2020. So we are almost at the 5-year anniversary.
Wow.
It has changed and evolved several times, which is normal. I always tell my editor, Mario, in case you remember meeting Mario, I always tell him that if we're doing the same thing, you know, in 2 years, although we literally change something major every year, but like, I always tell him, like, if we're doing the same thing in 2 years, then we're doing something wrong. So it's no longer a 10-minute show. It's now short videos, short form videos sprinkled throughout the week. That was one of the biggest changes we took last year, for example. That made an instant change in viewership and subscribers on its own without any marketing money. This is self-funded, so I don't have much to offer. This year, one of the biggest changes I've made is actually because the news is so weird now. Like, we're in such a weird world now where if you explain anything, first of all, it's news, like everyone's being drowned in news. And I don't see that as being lucrative anymore. People are drowning out. They're like, I can't anymore. I don't want to listen to this anymore. I don't want news anymore. So there's that. And then there's also people are very quick to judge you. So like, you make fun of something or you explain something and people are like, you're a Trumper. You know, you're a crazy leftist anarchist, right? Like, and it gets to me. I wish it didn't, but it does get to me because I don't like that. My brand is it's so importantly objective. So I've pivoted this year to be more educational. To the stories that like you can search on, they're sparked by news on YouTube. You know, there'll be a news hook, but I take it as an opportunity to go back and be like, let me explain this to you, right? Like, I'll give you an example. This week, there's a video coming out on a super rat that smells landmines. And the news hook was that this super rat smelled 109 landmines, something like this, in the course of 3 years. And he's like the best rat at smelling landmines. And so this news comes out, but then it allowed me the opportunity to explain to people, there are 110 million landmines around the world. This is where they come from. There is a treaty against it. By the way, the U.S. hasn't signed this treaty, right? So it allows me to go back and be educational about it. And so that's what I've tried to pivot to because I think people are kind of like, ooh, a story, you know, like this is interesting and it's not going to make me set my hair on fire, you know, or down, you know, a bottle of Xanax. So that's the pivot I've taken this year.
I love that. Awesome. I love that. And guys, if you're not following All My World, you're missing out. As Hagar said, she does some sketches, putting it on wigs and performing as dictators. It's so much fun. So you chose satire to portray some of these situations happening around the world. Have you ever received pushback for how you present global affairs? And if so, how do you handle the criticism?
Yeah, occasionally I have. So not often, which is good, but occasionally I have. So, for example, the one, the thing that, and this is, you have to walk a very fine line with satire and with the world that we live in. And satire ultimately is an exaggeration of the truth, in order to point out the humor and absurdity in something to convey a message, and that message is usually political or ideological or whatever in mind. And so first, there are times that I've had to remind people that this is satire, and that satire is not ba is it's loosely based on a real event, right? I've taken a real event and I've exaggerated it. Now, if they're actually paying attention to the show, they should have picked up on that, because usually I explain the news first and then I jump to, the I poke fun of Putin or Trump or, name your leader and exaggerate what it is they're saying, to poke fun at them, to kneecap them, really, right? To highlight the absurdity of something, or to convey some kind of message I'm trying to convey. So I've had to say that to people a shocking number of times, right? Like, where I'm like, it's not real. Like, it's, I'm in a wig. And so clearly, like, this, they'll be like, fake news. And I'm like, no, like, the first part's real and well researched. And then the satire is just there, right? So, but that's then it's not for them. The show's not for them then. So there's that. But the thing that I find, the one that's the hardest one to walk, or I guess two things that are really hard to walk, and that I really take personally, are when people either accuse me of being racist or discriminatory in some way, or when they accuse me of being one-sided to the left or to the right. Because I really am not, I'm not any of those things. I'm not any of those things. And so for the satire, I've taken great care in, like, whose accent I do and whose I don't. And maybe that's wrong, maybe it's right, I don't know. But so one person once told me that they really didn't think it was cool that I did an accent for Kim Jong-un. And I was like, okay. Yeah, I didn't take that personally. I thought that, I was like, yeah, you know what? You're right. That could really be misconstrued, as me trying to poke fun, at the wrong group of people. And so Kim Jong-un doesn't have an accent. When I do it, it has like a voice, like a decibel that I reach, because he's, it almost is a voice that, like, I assume he would make, but, like, I don't know if he does actually. Like, it's like a high-pitched voice. But I don't have an accent for him. Putin, I have an accent. Emmanuel Macron, I have an accent. Like, oh, Trump, I do his voice. Of course I do his voice, right? And so, that, so I'm careful with that. I keep getting asked, for example, to do Prime Minister Modi of India, and I'm just like, I just don't know that that will land well. Like, I think somebody could accuse me of being racist, and I could see it too. Like, I get it, right? Like, so sometimes I think my radar is on. I think it is, but you never know too, right? And times change. So this is a difficult one, and I've only been accused, I think, twice. There was one time with that the accent for Kim Jong-un, and I thought that was feedback I took, and I thought that was fair. But when there was one time I portrayed a Houthi terrorist and was told I was racist, and that one I completely rejected. I mean, I told them, I was like, yeah, no, They, like, this is a Houthi terrorist. This is what he did. It was a Houthi terrorist who is a TikToker, who showed on his, yeah, he, wait, you need to hear the story. Wait. It's like it's given for a satirist. He took his phone out, boarded one of the vessels that the Houthis attacked in the Red Sea. He boards one of the vessels and does a video on the vessel. And he's like, look at the vessel, blah, blah, blah. He's a Houthi terrorist. And TikTok goes mad for him because they think he's hot. All right. So they think, yeah. Okay. So they think he's hot. And so they start calling him the hot Houthi and Tim Houthi Chalamet. Like I said, this content is given. It's a
My God.
gift. So I dress up as the terrorist. Me and I'm on the boat, and I dress like him. I've got a beard, and, like, I mean, I look like him. I took the image, I put a wig, and I have a fan in my hair, and I'm like pretending to look at the camera, and I'm like blowing kisses or whatever. And then I dress as, it cuts to a teenage American girl, me also, and I say, like, yes, you're so terrorism chic. And he responds, and he goes, I will kill you. And the girl is like, yes, talk dirty to me. And he's like, no, I will kill you. And so I got called racist by several people for that one. And I was like, no, I'm trying to, no, I refuse that. I reject that completely. I was like, first of all, this is the Middle East. These are my people. I'm allowed to make fun of them. I was like, and second of all, this is exactly what happened. Like, I don't think I'm going absurd here. I think that anybody calling this hot Houthi, you know, like, no. No, terrorists are not hot. They are never hot. Learn that now. And I didn't care how I sounded. So, but I remember it bothered me that they called me racist. And I responded. And I do respond to a lot of people, especially when they are, if they're not like totally, if the comments aren't totally like, you know, angry and scary, if they just disagree, then I will respond. I'll be like, I hear you, but like, this is why I said this way, or this is how I view that. And I would say 50% of them end up seeing my side, or they'll be like, wow, thanks for that explainer, right? Like, yeah, if they're just like, you're a political prostitute, then I don't respond to that. You know, I'll be like, thanks. Like, thanks for helping the algorithm.
Oh, yeah. I do not think I'm on that side of TikTok to be seeing hot Houthis. That has never popped up. Nope, but that's an insane story, actually. I support your video with that.
That was a fun one.
It sounds fun. Now I'm laughing making that. Yeah. Okay, so what has been the most surprising or unexpected impact of Oh My World so far since its launch?
You know, even it's so funny because even though I launched this with the idea of the goal was to raise awareness and to get people to care about these issues. And I always say, what happens abroad matters very much here, and what we do here matters very much abroad. And they need to be aware. And there's a heavy focus on human rights and dictatorship in particular, because I just find these stories aren't shared that well sometimes or that publicly. And it can inform people's decision-making, right? Like if they know a certain clothing brand is made in Xinjiang, China, or if they know that Justin Bieber is going to be performing in Saudi Arabia, maybe they'll be like, no, dude, don't do that. Right? That's worked. We've seen it work. So, right? The three of us have seen things like this work where Tyga was going to perform in Belarus and you know, because of a public campaign, he changed his mind. Right?
There was a big call for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like these do work. When you raise awareness, people work, and that's the real power there that the consumer and regular viewer has. And so even though that is my goal, when it happens, when people, and by it, I mean when people react and they, when they respond by saying to me, or they reach out to me over email, or, you know, or they join now, I have a paid subscriber platform called Oh My World Extra, right? Where they like stranger, especially a stranger, right? Not a friend who's like gone out of their way to pay us a monthly fee to have more content and to join me. I have a monthly Zoom they can join. Then it's every time I'm like, my God, it's like the fuel I need to keep going. And even though the whole goal was to get to people who don't know me, who've never met me, to be like, you need to care about this. And when that happens, it's everything. Or when people come up to me and be like, I saw this story on the protests in Nigeria. This happened once. You know, I saw the story on the protests in Nigeria, and my mother's nurse is Nigerian, and I got into a whole conversation about it. And like, as a result, she like is just like giving us all this extra, me and my mom, all this extra love, and like, because she knows I like understand her country and culture. And it was all because of you, right? Like, when I hear that stuff, yeah, that's when, even though that was the whole goal, but like, even when I hear it from one person, I'm like, I'm achieving the goal. I'm achieving the mission. And it gives me the energy to continue.
I think I've definitely felt that with the podcast, and we've just started and we're only about 4 months into this, but I have friends who are like, my sister listens to you, my fiance listens to you, like my cousin listens to you. And I'm like, wait, this is amazing. That was like, yes, that's why we started it. But it is like so amazing catching here from a live person.
Sometimes I put out a video and I'm like, Bueller, anybody, Bueller. And you know, like, and so then when one person says something, you're like, oh my God, it's like you just recharged my battery. And it's a tough world out there. This space is, media is a very tough world. It's not for the thin skinned. It's not for the faint of heart. I remember I did a YouTube tutorial before launching my show. The heart of Oh My World is really on YouTube. So please go subscribe there. It's not really on the other platforms as much. On TikTok, I can't understand half of what people say. I really can't. I'm like, did you like the video? Did you not? Like, I don't understand. What is this? What is, you're speaking emojis. Like, I literally don't understand it. Are you a bot? Like, on Instagram is really where the community, the diehard fans are. So I get less of that commentary there now. And on YouTube is where, like, YouTube's amazing. It's amazing how these videos reach people, and people will comment, you know, and they'll ask questions and so on. And that is definitely something I should make that as a resolution a halfway through the year. To one quarter through the year, resolution is to respond better, because I'm good at responding on Instagram, but not as good on YouTube. I really need to. I do eventually do it, or I see the comments and I'll like them, but like I need to respond better, because people, it's amazing that they take the time to respond, and yeah, it's really it goes a long way.
Yeah, and also YouTube Shorts is a growing feature. So
yeah, YouTube Shorts, by the way, changed a lot for Oh My World. It changed. It's like a free marketing tool. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So Oh My World is almost 5 years old. Congratulations. But just that's just Oh My World, like your whole like career journey. I feel like you've lived like 1,000 lives right now. So if you could go back and give your younger self career advice, what would it be?
You know what? It would probably be, because I was always a very, you know, I don't want to say high strung, like that wasn't it, but I was and I remain very, very type A, very go getter, very ambitious, and a little bit of a worrywart. And I think I would go back and say, and I still have to remind myself about this, by the way, I figured I could give myself my own advice, is to not worry so much, right? Like it'll all work out, and it all works out for a reason. And it really does. And there are chapters through my life that I have faced that. One of my favorite stories is when I applied for a PhD program a few years into government, thinking like, I need a PhD. This is what you do. All secretaries of state are PhD. That's so not true now, by the way, but that was the case back then. And then my boss, Danny Glazer, same guy, Danny was like, you don't need a PhD. Don't waste your time on a PhD. You're going to go, you're going to take yourself out of the workforce for 5 years. And like 5 years is a crazy amount of time in the workforce, especially in government. And I was convinced. I was like, no, I want to do this. Can you write me a letter? And so he did. He wrote me the most amazing letter. And then I didn't get into one program, not one program. And one of the programs in particular was at Harvard, and I can never forget this, and I love sharing this story, where I had this amazing meeting with this woman and at the Harvard Kennedy School, and it's going swimmingly, and she's like, this is just great, you're great, like I could really see this working out. And then she tells me, she's like, how's your calculus? And I was like, this was, by the way, a PhD in Middle Eastern studies, let's put that out there. Okay. It was in the context of international affairs, but Middle Eastern studies, and each school was different. Each school had different, but I remember for Harvard, it was Middle Eastern studies. And so I was like, calculus? And she was like, yes. Like, how was your calculus in college? And I was like, well, I didn't take calculus in college. It wasn't required for my political science degree. But I took AP calculus, which is the, you know, a high level, college level, technically, as a senior, and I did very well. And, you know, if it's a requirement, I'd be happy to take it again over the summer. I thought that was a very good response. And she goes like this. And your listeners are listening, so they're not seeing me, but imagine my hands are out like, you know, 3 feet wide. And she was like, oh, the door was like this, and it just got like this. And she takes those hands and puts them like an inch apart. And I was like, I wanted to cry. Oh my God.
The sass. Oh my goodness.
Such snobbery. Like, bitch, did you take calculus? I doubt it. And so I was like, you know, I could feel the tears welling up. And I was like, just get the hell out of this house. And like that was it. She really was like, I guess this movie's over. I mean, like, because I hadn't taken calculus in college, even though, by the way, I took college level calculus as a senior. Nope. Like, maybe she was looking for an excuse. I don't know. Maybe the meeting was not as going swimmingly as I thought. But that said, I didn't get into any program. And 6 months later, I got the job at the White House. And that job at the White House really charted the rest of my career, because that's where, first of all, you're at the White House, so you've been kind of, you're at the creme la creme, and you make all these other connections. But that's where I learned my love of communications. And that shifted, that changed everything. You know, my next two jobs in government were a spokesperson, were in that field. And then I left, and I stayed in that field still. I love that field. The marriage of international affairs and communications. And so, so that would have never happened. And so but I remember being so bummed. And so that, I have faced that still to this day. We all do. We all will. But to try and take a step back and be like, you know what? It all works out for a reason. There are other plans, whether it's because you're religious and God has other plans, or the universe and the universe has other plans. Like, it works out for a reason. Just like, trust the process.
Definitely. Definitely. So quickly diving into more women specific, do you have any advice for women looking to break into the male dominated fields like national security or media in general?
Yes. Partner up with other women because you are stronger together, and never shit on another woman. Doesn't mean you have to necessarily vote for other women, by the way. I mean, you should vote for who you want to vote for. But like, I mean, whatever industry you're in, find other women and like link arms and you know, because you will find in government, I was very lucky. Most of my bosses were men, and they only sought to empower me and other women and to promote us to leadership positions and to have us to have opportunities to take the seat at the table, to take, you know, have trips to, you name it. I was very, very fortunate. I don't know that that was unique in government. I think that that's unique to the rest of the world. So there I had a good opportunity. I had a good experience. But at the White House, under Obama, at the beginning of the Obama tenure, it was really like a bro club at the beginning, right? Like very bro-y. It was a group of bros, literally, that had campaigned for Obama. And to be fair, they were allowed to be friends and bro-y. I mean, they had gone on this campaign together and whatever. But the problem with that was that they were like, you know, first of all, half the talk was bro-y, right? It's like about sports and not on drinking. I don't know what else they want to talk about. And then they were talking.
I feel like I can't picture that.
Right? And, yeah. And so like, you want to sit there and talk Lebanon or whatever. And they're just like, 20 minutes of sports, and you're just sitting there like, can we get to my portfolio now? And then they'd sometimes meet up at the gym or at the bar and then end up making decisions on your portfolio. And the next day you'd learn like, oh, by the way, and they didn't mean it in a bad way. They were well-intentioned. They were just like, yeah, so by the way, we talked about your issue and we came up with this idea. And you're like, fuck you, I wasn't there. Like, you're not, this is my portfolio. You're not allowed to do that. And so we had a group of women that met for dinner every month or other month that Samantha Power is the one who grouped us together. And we were a very small group of us at that time. It was 200. The staff was about 200 or over 200. And we were about 11 or 12 women. And she grouped us together. And we decided that we would call on each other in meetings, that we would, you know, like, and call on each other first. And if there was like a mansplainer, that we would kind of cut him off and be like, or if a mansplainer took credit for someone's idea, we'd be like, wasn't that her idea? So we kind of made that as a pact. But then she went to the chief of staff at the time and said, like, you guys don't realize you're doing this. It's probably not your intention, but like, you've facilitated this culture. And not only have you facilitated this culture, but you're not hiring women. Like, you gotta change that. And he did. He really did. And I didn't like that guy that much, but like, I will say to his credit, he within like a year, it was like 50% women in the NSC in leadership roles and in the staff. And that bro culture disappeared. Maybe on their own, but like they never did that again in meetings. He really took action on that. And so so yeah, like it was, you know, so that says, and I've had faced that before in media for sure. Like I said about the contributorship. So you have to gang together, you have to band together and make demands together and watch out for each other and support each other. And that's the best way. And also find the male allies, right? Like the men who are like, yeah, actually I will promote women, more women. I didn't realize that. A lot of men don't realize it. And they're more than happy to like kind of extend a hand to pull someone up, you know, they just sometimes need to be told. But yeah, in my experience, they're usually more than happy to help.
I love that. I mean, at the end of it, we need to work together, right? Mm-hmm. Men and women. So I love that for sure. We're wrapping up this interview, sadly, but we have two last questions, our favorite ones personally. So if you could have any world leader guest star on All My World, who would it be and why?
A world leader guest star? Oh my God. Hands down, Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is such a character. And he was when he was prime minister of the UK, he was my favorite person to impersonate because he's so ridiculous. Like, his hair is a mess and he says the craziest things. Like, he'll be talking politics and then all of a sudden he'll be talking about like Peppa Pig. And like, he is but I used to say, like, there were some weeks where I couldn't think of like the funny skit to open the show with. And I would just like, literally all I had to do was Google what Boris Johnson did that week. So I would say probably Boris Johnson. Yeah, for sure. Right now, my favorite person to impersonate is Putin, but not because I like him, obviously. It's because It's fun to mock dictators in particular, because you feel like I make them look so dumb on purpose. The Russian accent is a fun one to do. And I have everybody knows by now his wig, so I can't use his wig for anything else. I have a wall of wigs, and most of them are used. We all have names, names of the characters they play, but many of them have double uses, not his. I can't, because I wouldn't invite him on my show though. I probably get sanctioned for that, he's my currently favorite person to impersonate, because I like the idea of mocking him.
That's awesome. Okay, final question, my favorite one to ask. We're actually going to make a little Spotify playlist of everyone's answers here. But if your life had a theme song, what would it be?
Oh my God. Oof, I'm not good at songs. I will say that I would say there are two songs, there are two songs in particular that I feel I listen to a lot more than I'd like to admit, because they both have this theme of kind of never giving up and always trying, and that your story is not going to be private, right? That you're going to share your story, and you're going to be big, and you're going to be public, and you're going to, you're going to affect change, and you're going to fight for something amazing. And those two songs are first Try Everything by Shakira. It's in a movie in Zoo something. It's a Disney movie.
Oh,
Zoo,
yeah. Something.
Yeah, thank you. I was never going to get that. I haven't even watched Zootopia. It was on, my kids were watching it, and I was doing the dishes one day, and I was what is this song? I love this song. And so that's one of them, Try Everything, which is very much about falling down and picking yourself up back up, basically, and succeeding. And then the other one is, I'm going to have to pull it up. Give me a second. It's by, I never remember the name, but this is, it just gets me going every time. And I love it. And this movie, oh my God, this song is from Sing 2. You must think I get all my music from Disney or animated movies. That's not true, but I'm not that good sometimes with these, with music, but it is true that these are my two favorite. One second.
I always think it's a funny, we ask this question to everybody, but I think it's funny because I'm also horrible at naming songs. So if someone asked me this question, if you turned around and gave me this question right now, I would have to think really hard about it.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. But I do have these two. Had you asked me years ago, because these are really recent additions, years ago, I don't know what I would have told you. So the song, it was Could Have Been Me, and it's by Halsey. Oh no, that's from Sing 2. The song originally is from a different, it's from a band, Could Have Been Me by the Struts. And it's so good. In the movie Sing 2, it's the coyote dressed as an alien who sings it, the daughter of the scary director guy, whatever. And she sings it. So Could Have Been Me, which, and that one is more about I'm going to tell my story, no one's going to hide me. I'm going to tell my story. It should be me. So those two songs. Yeah.
I love those two songs. And I love those two movies too. So
those
were great answers. So this has been amazing, Hagar. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to add as we wrap up this episode?
No, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to be here. I talked so much. I hope this isn't, I feel like it's a tad longer than some of your other episodes, but don't forget to subscribe. Oh My World Show, wherever you are, I am there. And if anybody has ideas too, impersonate this person, then let me know. I'm happy to do it.
Perfect. We love that. Yeah. Go follow On My World. And Hagar, this has been such an insightful and energizing conversation. Thank you so much. Your journey from working in national security to creating On My World is truly inspiring. And your passion for making global affairs both accessible and engaging is something we'll need more of. So guys, again, don't forget to check out On My World across platforms and follow Hagar for more sharp take on world news. And for our listeners, make sure to follow us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and TikTok at Goldgirl Podcast for updates and great content. And don't forget to tune in. We have bi-weekly episodes you won't want to miss. So see you soon.